This is an ABC podcast.
Over 100 years ago, Gustav Weindorfer and his wife Kate built a guest house at Cradle Mountain in the remote central highlands of Tasmania. With gabled roofs and a wooden porch, the house, called Waldheim, looked like a chalet that you might find in the Austrian Alps. Far away from the busy life of cities and towns, Gustav and Kate could give over to their passion for botany, coming to know the rocks and streams, the wombats and the wallabies. Gustav spent months alone at Waldheim in the silence and the snow, with only animals for company. As he wrote to a friend, "When the ground is all covered with snow, I do build a big fire, open my door, seat myself very, very quietly in front of the blazing logs, and presently, one by one, they would come, without their usual fear of man or one another, and share with me in stillness the grateful warmth." The singular love story between Gustav and Kate, and of them both for the Tasmanian wilderness, is told by Kate Legg in Kindred, a Cradle Mountain love story. Hi, Kate.
Hi,
Sarah.
Take me back to 1903, to a meeting of the Field Naturalists Club of Victoria. Kate Cowell took the podium. What did she talk about?
Well, she spoke about the botany and geology of Mount Rowland, which is near Sheffield, a town at the foothills, really, of Cradle Mountain. And she spoke about having her climb up to the top and the vegetation that she walked through, the stinkwood, the musk, the dogwoods, counting them all off as though they were a class of children. And she, the line that really stuck in my mind was describing the mountain's tug on her heart as the silent outreach of the soul toward eternal beauty. And there she was at the Royal Society building, a very elegant Victorian building in Melbourne, surrounded by bookshelves and tall ceilings and a very cultured audience. And she was the first woman that year, or the only woman that year, to give a paper to the naturalists. And the men who were present at the conversation afterwards admired her daring in you know, traipsing through such rough terrain.
What would she have worn to climb Mount Rowland?
Well, she would have worn an ankle-length skirt, layers of woolen underwear. She would have had stout boots that would have been waxed with beeswax or rendered fat, and her beribboned hat and a bodiced collared shirt, long-sleeved shirt. Protective, I guess, against being scratched, but cumbersome and difficult to walk in. But she never spoke of those because it was just something you accepted, I guess, and she did it without complaint.
So she'd grown up in Tasmania but was now living in Melbourne. Why had she left her hometown?
Well, she'd lost her brother, a younger brother who she was very close to, her father, her mother and a stepmother.
Had all died
within the space of 5 years, and so she'd inherited a small estate from her father, and so with her two other single sisters, Carrie and Laura, she crossed Bass Strait to Melbourne. And I think that it was because she wanted, you know, she was an adventurous soul and she wanted a new life and strike out on her own, be independent, away from family. She didn't want to become a spinster aunt indentured to looking after her nephews and nieces.
So they had a bit of freedom, these three unmarried sisters in Melbourne.
Yeah, absolutely. They took rooms in a terraced house in East Melbourne in Clarendon Street. The building's no longer there. And all joined the Field Naturalist Club. So wonderful excursions through Bayside Heath and mountain ranges. They'd go out every weekend collecting. And, of course, it was through the club that she met this wonderfully charismatic, attractive Austrian immigrant called Gustav Weindorfer. And he was in the audience when she gave that paper on Mount Rowland. And I think she was probably already on his radar, but listening to her speak of mountains, because he came, he was bred in Alpine Heights, I think he surely must have fallen in love with her then.
So what kind of childhood did Gustav have in Austria? Did he spend much time out in nature?
Yes, all the time, walking in the mountains, very popular pastime. And his mother often speaks, well, she spoke in early letters that she received from him, teasing him for calling Australian Alps our Alps, forgetting about the Mickelhofen Hills back home. He was someone who wasn't very academic, but the subjects he loved, he was very good at. So forestry and agriculture were the things he loved. And he worked in sort of odd jobs as a salesman for a vineyard, but nothing really grabbed him. And he read voraciously as a young boy. So he'd read the writings of an Australian anthropologist called Alfred Howitt, who had been in the search party for Burke and Wills. He used to devour the Wide World magazine for men, which was full of tall tales of escapades, you know, down the Amazon, over the Khyber Pass, Tibet, New Guinea. And I think he really was one of those boys who just imagined himself sailing to a foreign country and making a great discovery.
Well, what kind of planning went into his decision to emigrate from Austria to Australia?
Well, not much. It seems as a rather sudden decision. He got the money from his sister Rosa. His father had a very interesting chapter in life himself and had been living on the east coast of Africa, in Somalia, working for the German East Africa Company. And because he had been in charge of a council and there'd been some fraud, and he, in those days, you either had to commit suicide or leave. So he chose to leave, even though the money was repaid and he wasn't responsible for this council fraud. He went and lived in Somalia and wasn't able to come back to Austria until 1903, when he was given a pardon. So there's an inference that perhaps this was also, this shadow was hanging over Gustav, and he just wanted to get out, get away from the family history and make his name on his own.
What impression did the Australian bush first make on Gustav when he arrived?
Well, he got off in the searing heat of a summer in Western Australia in Fremantle, and he was bereft, and he described his first glimpse of eucalypts as these wretched creatures with rattling leaves. And, you know, it would have looked, I think, fairly grim to someone who's come from Europe. And he came east, and of course then he roamed everywhere and fell in love with everything he saw, from acacias to mountain ashes to Banksia to Red River Gums, and even the Mallee he found was far from destitute of charm. So he studied, read, collected, absorbed everything, and it was a sense, I think, of a new land which really didn't take its botany very seriously at the turn of the century, and he felt that he could make his mark and bring it to light and cause us to fall in love with it as well.
What did Gustav look like at this stage of his life in his early 20s?
Now, he was a very attractive young man. He had dark hair, although it did begin to thin on top rather early.
Not that that detracts from anyone's attractiveness, Kate. We're a broad church of conversations. Yeah.
And he was very energetic. You know, he just radiated energy, I think, in the sense that he was bound somewhere, you know, itchy-footed, always on the march, looking out for everything. And I think he was just one of those exciting personalities that never sit still and therefore have a certain, you know, a frisson about them. And she clearly, I think, fell head over heels in love with him. And who wouldn't? She was 40. She was 11 years older than him. He was a younger man. But it was such a big embrace of her, really, to, you know, she was unlikely to have children. Unlikely. I think she probably resigned herself to the fact she wouldn't meet anybody. And here strides in Gustav with his sensibility, his European tradition of kissing women's hands. So he had all of that European sophistication, but also they shared this passion for botany and for flowers and for the bush. And you know, it was just a marriage made in heaven, really, to meet someone so similar to you.
And I guess someone who took her interest seriously and responded to the things that she was clearly passionate about. Apart from their time together at the Naturalist Club and bushwalking, how did they get to know each other in those early years? How did they spend their time?
Well, she was a pianist, quite an accomplished pianist. She'd actually played it publicly in Devonport in a hall with her brother. And she also played the fiddle and the flute, and he sang. He had a beautiful voice. So they would, according to one of the lodgers who shared her East Melbourne terrace, in the evenings they would take out their collections, label them, dry them, preserve them, name them, and then they would retire to the piano and they would he would sing and she would play. And I can just hear them together.
How did their respective families react to this decision to get married?
Well, her sister, Laura, had married a Canadian younger than her. So there was a precedent in their family for that. Of course, she'd never met his parents until 1908 when they came out to Australia. And so all they had to go on was a photograph and his description. So again, it was a bold move on her part to accept someone who had no, she didn't know where he came from. She didn't really, only what he had told her. She couldn't Google him to see whether or not he was in fact true to his word.
And he didn't come with money.
And he came with absolutely no money. No, he was on a very small salary working for an Austrian shipping agency. embassy, and he had an honorary job with the Austrian Consul General, but that was it. So he had no money, but she did. She had the means. And I just think she had that pluck to catch this soaring star and follow it and see where it went. You know, she wasn't held back by all of those fears and second guesses and doubts that you might have meeting someone who, you know nothing about really other than what they've told you.
So they decided to get married, and they got married in Tasmania. How did Gustav spend the night before their wedding?
Yes, well, they were married. It was a very small wedding because he, didn't have any friends. And in fact, I wasn't able to ever to identify who his groomsman was. I don't know whether he was just plucked from the local village of Stowport, where Kate's elder brother Preslin lived, and that's where they were going to be married, in the church. But the day before the wedding was due, it was a fire that swept through up, threatening the property. All of the men in the surroundings had to go and fight the fire all through the night to stop it burning down the Carl's house.
Including Gustav,
yes. And so an extraordinary event, really, on the eve of one's wedding. But they didn't marry in the church. They married in the front room at Stowport because the church had some fire damage. But it all went ahead. You know, in those days, I think you just got on with things. And they were really a couple who did that. They never paused or doubted. They just took off.
Where did they spend their honeymoon, Kate?
Well, they went to Penguin on the coast for one night, and then they went to Mount Roland with a tent and provisions, which were marched up the hill by a family that lived just below Mount Roland. So this is a 5,000-foot mountain. They're on the plateau for 6 weeks in a tent. They endured blizzards, snowstorms. The tent blew down a number of times. There were mosquito infestations, but they were in absolute wedded bliss. You know, they couldn't believe their luck. They had their fiddle flute, so they made music at night by the fire. They cooked kangaroo tail soup and just spent days rummaging and foraging through the alpine flora.
Tell me about the letters that they wrote to the local newspaper while they were on their honeymoon.
And they're fascinating letters. They're under the pseudonym of Mike O'Flanagan and Pat Hegarty, who were two, they were imagined characters, of course. And I suspect that they began writing them when they had been tent-bound for several days when it had been so wet, describing these honeymooners who they'd never seen before. And their eyes were out on sticks. Both of them visited the tent when the couple were not there, and describing this advanced post of civilization with couches and food and hams and jams. And, you know, there's a consciousness in these letters of how strange they must appear to other people. And it's a sort of done with a swaggering pride between the two of them that they could be so different. And at one point, Pat describes, because Gustav would go down the mountain to get provisions and to take down some of the blotting paper specimens that they had preserved of flowers. And there he describes this, seeing this woman sitting there with her six-shooter in her hand and wondering whether or not he should introduce himself, of course, because if he went for his pocket, she might think it's a gun and then he'd be killed. And at the last letter, Pat wonders whether or not, what have they got in their bags? He thought it might have been a dead kangaroo, but no, it was a lot of plants, and he thinks that they're from the Naturalist Club, and, well, Pat thinks maybe I am too, you know. And so it's a sense of them being up there too, that there's a changing view, there's an awakening to the beauty of being up there. They also met some picnickers while they were up there, which was a group of women and men who'd come up there for an afternoon tea. So there's a gradual sense that Australians are learning to venture into their wild, into their backyard, and discover the delights and spectacles that are there.
You mentioned that local farmers' kids had helped them cart all their stuff up Mount Roland. Many, many years later, when that girl was an old woman, how did she remember helping them back down again?
Extraordinary story, because Kate had given, it was Annie and her brother, and Kate had a present for each of them, the book and a doll, but she gave the doll to the brother and the book to Annie. And as a 90-year-old woman, Annie still remembered that sort of slight insult, I guess, because the reversal of gender stereotypes. She obviously really wanted the doll. I'm not quite sure what her brother did with it.
She didn't remember it as a great moment of female liberation.
It stuck in her mind as one of those things that you just don't ever forget, because it was a strange reversal of tradition. And it just shows, I guess, that Kate was a very different sort of woman. I just can't imagine why on earth she would have done that if it wasn't perhaps to encourage a little bit more femininity on the boy's part and perhaps a more adventuring soul on the girl's part.
How did Gustav and Kate plan on supporting themselves in Tasmania? What were they going to do?
Well, they were going to buy a farm, and during this 6 weeks on the when they were honeymooning on top of Mount Roland, they came down once to see whether or not they could strike a deal with Kate's brother Dan, who'd inherited the family estate at Kindred. And, you know, after much argy-bargy and bargaining, they were able to negotiate sale of a portion of that estate, and Kate and Gustav were going to farm and grow potatoes and oats. And they hadn't yet, I think, really threshed out what the idea for a chalet and a summit. That came later in 1909. So they married in 1906 and then moved onto the farm and planted. They had to renovate a house, build a house for themselves and plant.
What sort of impression did they make on this tiny little community of Kindred when they arrived?
Well, they shook it up. They really shook it up. And again, it's that, well, it's mostly Gustav, I think, in the sense of he had just learnt not to be afraid. He'd come from Austria to Melbourne, to Perth, to Melbourne, now Tasmania. He was an early adapter of everything, so he became very involved in community meetings and politics. He was one of the first farmers to import a Babcock milk tester, which he then offered to lend out to others.
Sorry, a what?
Babcock milk tester. It's a device for measuring the quality of cream. But again, you know, very early in bringing this technique in, they grew fruit trees, and that was just taking off in the district. So again, he got an orchardist in and invited fellow farmers to come in. Kate was very involved in the church. She set up a choir, and she would play at socials and things like that that they had in Kindred, which is a tiny little town where everyone knew each other's business, obviously. And that was apparently so cool because of people who were related to each other.
They Everyone were kindred, was kindred
souls. Yeah, kindred souls. But from there, they could see, they'd obviously seen Cradle Mountain from the top of Mount Roland, and they could see Mount Roland and Black Buff and Cradle from a hill on their property. And I think it must have beckoned to them.
So could Gustav still go off exploring even while this setting up of the farm and
yes.
the milk testing and the orchardist was all happening?
Yes, he always did that. You know, even when they went on their first trip up to Mount Buffalo, you know, he took off to Mount Bogong 30 kilometres away because it was too close to be, you know, couldn't resist it. And I think she must have just acknowledged that that was part of who he was. And although they were both very unconventional and did unconventional things, she was still bound by convention to some extent, and she didn't always accompany him. And I think sometimes too that was probably because of the roughness of the country when he was going, you know, these places there were no tracks or roads often. He had a very close relationship with a Carlton GP called Charles Sutton, who he used to travel a lot, and I think she just accepted that was they were a buddy twosome, and that she wasn't going to get in his way when he went out on his own. She sort of respected his need to be independent. I think it
was still so new for Europeans to be walking in this landscape. How dangerous could it be for white fellas?
Well, really dangerous. And we as a nation, you know, we really clung to the coastal veranda for so long because we saw the bush as a forbidding place. It was somewhere where you'd either get disoriented or lost, or you'd be bitten by a snake. And there's a lovely story that was told around the opening of Buffalo where the someone returned from Buffalo safely, and he's asked by his daughter, did he see any snakes up there? And he says, no snakes, but I saw glory. And I think the idea that, you know, the outback, the bush, our backyard had these wondrous spectacles, it made the landscape less forbidding and encouraged us into the wild.
How long was it then before Kate and Gustav managed to go together to Cradle Mountain for the first time?
Well, his parents came to visit them in 1908. They stayed for 2 years, which is considerable time, but then it's a long way to come. And once they had got into the routines of the farm, they arranged a trip with a local bushman called Ron Smith, who's actually from a very esteemed family in Tasmania. His father was Philosopher Smith, who discovered the Mount Bischoff mine, and Ron Smith was named after a famous botanist, Ronald Campbell Gunn. And so Ron had already been up to visit Cradle Mountain in the late 1890s, and so he knew, you know, had some intelligence on how to go about getting there, and that was when they went. So they went in December 1909, and they camped at Middlesex Plains near Black Bluff, and then in Cradle Valley at Cradle Lake, and then finally they climbed the summit in January 1910.
And Kate's still in her ankle-length skirt.
Absolutely.
For this?
Yes.
What about having...
Took a little longer than the men. They got up there first, but she got there on her own steam. And this was the fourth mountain she'd climbed. Well, three mountains, one of them twice. But so, you know, very unusual at that time to do that
had
sort of thing.
Had other white women climbed?
No other white women that we know of. Yeah, she was the first white woman there because there were no tracks. And, you know, it was very hard going. And he had already tried to do it once with Charles Sutton and they'd had to turn around because fog had descended and that got lost. So this was his first time up on the summit as well. And they stayed there for 3 hours.
You know, on top of the mountain?
On top of the mountain, looking around, naming as many peaks as they could. It was a beautiful day and that's a rare thing up there. And they could see right to the ocean on the north coast and the west coast. And it was while they were walking around, I think, that he enunciated this idea for a tourist chalet that they would build and in a national park that would be open to all. And this was because of the air they'd breathed together. And the other two who were with them, there was Ron Smith and there was one other bushman, Walter Malcolm Black. And they were they weren't at all convinced that this, you know, who was going to pay for it, how on earth was it going to unravel, how would the park be declared. Much happier, those two, just to stay with their, you know, I think Black was a miner and Ron was not interested in joining this, you know, venture.
But so right from the start, Gustav wanted not just to build a chalet, but to have it declared a national park.
And I think this was because of the Buffalo experience, because they'd been to Buffalo with the Field Naturalist just after it had opened. They'd seen these rudimentary hospices that were built.
This is in Victoria.
This is in Victoria. And they thought, you know, this is something we could do and we can do it here. And they also, because of their botanical knowledge, they really understood the significance of the landscape. I think that they did. You know, he was fascinated by the myrtles and the Kimberley pine and the dolerite, Precambrian dolerite rock. You know, they understood from the very beginning that this was a place that, you know, contained secrets into the natural world.
Do you have a sense, Kate, whether this was Gustav's idea or was Kate caught up in his enthusiasm too?
Well, we only know of this because Ron Smith has chronicled this moment on the summit. And being a man, I mean, he just left out her bit. But I'm sure because she had been there with him and she'd seen it and she'd embraced it, you know, the trip up to Mount Buffalo they'd been on together, and she would have understood and they would have talked about it. And they both loved mountains. And I think they both loved this landscape in their bones. They really did. And I think she would have been with him every inch of the way with him on this. Yeah, it wouldn't have been. Maybe he enunciated the idea, but, you know, this is the way couples do. But she would have been there in the background egging him on and encouraging him.
What sort of site did they settle on to build this guest house?
Well, the very next day, of course, because Gustav was just so impatient with everything, he went down to the valley and he stepped out this land that was near Hounslow Heath and on just very near a loose leaf creek, which is a tumbling creek. He described it as a singing, sang to him. And they were near a copse of Kimberley, native Kimberley pine, myrtle and deciduous beech. So beautiful, you know, ancient trees, a very sort of damp forest, lots of lichen and liverwort. I mean, if you've ever been to those forests, the decaying logs are often tapestried in ruffles of orange lichen or grey liverwort or luminous green mosses, which she loved. They were Kate's favourite, the small, exquisitely wrought plant life. And he, of course, you know, he loved everything. But this was a beautiful forest and, you know, has been photographed by the photographers that came there later in the piece. It was a gorgeous spot and it was sheltered. They had a lovely view of the valley and that was where a year later, they began building the chalet out of Kimberley pine. He would split palings by hand. And it, as you described it before, it is an exquisite building, even though what is there now is a replica. You know, it had European elements to the design, but because it was built from the pine, it really, I think, took on, it became like a third cousin of the trees in the forest because it paled and greyed and weathered and aged in that, in all the weather that you get up there.
What about all the furnishings inside, like the stove and the bath? How did they get up there?
Well, the stove and the bath, of course, he carried up on his back with the help of a local nurseryman.
Because there was no road to this
place.
There was
no road at all.
And so through the bush he's carrying
them. Through the bush on his back, yes. And that is, that is how they had to do it. Everything else he made by hand, the table, the chairs, were all made out of trunks of trees. So a glass was the only manufactured product in the design, and of course, the bath and the stove, which the stove came up first, and then later he built the bathhouse. And he was so ingenious. You know, he built the bathhouse and he hollowed out a log that he would hang in the creek, and it would funnel water into the bath, and there was a cauldron underneath the bath, and you could heat it for guests. That he did that much later, of course. In the early days, it was very roughly hewn. And they had this beautiful Inglenook fireplace that they built, which was a real conversation pit, and it was the hearth and the centrepiece of this room. It had a warm wombat skin rug out on the front of it, as you said before, when you were describing the animals that would come in one by one at night to sit by that fire.
And how else was it furnished inside?
Wood everywhere. The mantle was made from boughs, robed in bark, huge mantelpiece. There was a sense of books and learning there, because there were shelves, and of course he collected journals, periodicals, and there was sprigs of flowers, baronia on the mantelpiece, you know, bird skulls, all sorts of bits and pieces. So he really had this, exuded this sense of learning and sophistication, and there was a wheezy gramophone that was always playing classical music. So a sense of great sophistication.
Podcast, broadcast and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski.
Kate, you're describing this beautiful sounding home that Gustav had built with his own bare hands. Did he ever pause to think, would people trek out? The fact there's no roads, there's no path to this extremely isolated part of Tasmania. Did that give him pause for thought at all?
I don't think it did. And I think that's the classic for a person of his ilk, because if you dare to look down, you'll stumble. And if you have to be deaf to the naysayers and the doubters, and there were many of them who couldn't fathom what they'd found in this remote forbidding haunt, because it was only in 1905 that a young trapper had died on the slopes, and there'd been two search parties to try and retrieve him. So that's how most people saw the mountain, as a dangerous place. And so he and Kate had to work really hard to encourage, you know, mountaineers, prospectors and trappers would always, you know, venture up there, but it's the rest of us who he had to con.
When he was there in those months building the chalet, could he and Kate keep in contact at all?
Yes, through letters, but they would take weeks to, you know, get the 47 miles down the mountain to where she was. But she yearned for those letters, and she hated having to go home to run the farm, because somebody had to do it, and she took on that responsibility bravely and boldly. And she had a male, you know, servant, well, farm labourer, who really resented, I think, being told by a woman what to do, and so he was very obstreperous, and she had to manage that. But she really missed him, and even though she was in a more communal place and he was absolutely isolated up there, she felt the lonelier, I think, because she missed his voice, and she'd fallen so deeply in love with him that I think she, you know, she found those absences difficult. And not being up there with him, you know, because this was, wow, what a dream. You know, there they were, snug together in this beautiful little chalet in this wild place that they likened to, you know, an El Dorado for botanists. They were just in seventh heaven.
When she was back managing the farm in Kindred, could she see Cradle Mountain?
Yes, she could, and she would, you know, I think that was enormously comforting to her, that she knew the weather at least up there. And so she would often talk to him, I saw that there were storm clouds today, low down, you must have been having snow. So they would be able to talk through what she could see.
How did the letters reach him up there at Cradle Mountain?
Well, they would be put at Daisy Dell, which was on the Middlesex Plains, below about 20 miles down from the mountain, and the postman would come on horse and pack horse, and he would deliver them there or at Wilmot, so he'd pick them up there. But, it, you know, letter writing was so important in those days, of course, because that was the only way you could remain in contact.
Was anyone else reading their letters, Kate?
Yes. that was the interesting thing, because whenever her letters went to her sister Laura, Laura would always complain in Devonport that their letters had rubby paw prints all over them because people had opened them, read them, and then tried to stick them down again.
A slur against the post offices of Tasmania. What were they doing, reading their letters?
Well, clearly, because they were so exciting, and they wanted to and to listen in to what was happening up there, because they understood the value of timber, minerals, and possum skins, but they didn't have a clue. They didn't have a column in their ledger for science and scenery. And so what were these two doing up there? It was a mystery that they tried to solve.
Was there something more, do you think, about the perhaps slightly peculiar or different sort of relationship or characters of Kate and Gustav that might have aroused people's curiosity?
Well, yes, I think because of his foreignness and, love of garlic and coffee, the hat even, he would turn it up rather than down at the brim. And, I just think that they were such live wires and doing something that no one had really considered doing before on this imaginative quest that they went together along for. And I think that there was this misunderstanding that people just couldn't get them. As with any, visionary, by the time we've woken up to them, they've gone, long gone. It often takes us that amount of time.
When he had finally finished building this little guest house, what did they decide to call it?
Waldheim, which is German. It's a compound noun. Wald means forest in German and Heim means home. And so that was, again, a brave move, really, because it was quite different and distinct from hospices, hotels and other sorts of accommodation.
And did visitors start arriving straight away?
Well, their friends did. They were supported by members of the Naturalist Club and one or two locals who'd got drawn into the enterprise. But, they wrote this early advertising brochure where they deleted, actually, a paragraph about the fact that these harmless creeks can turn into raging torrents after heavy rains that only experienced buccaneers can ford with safety. So they dropped that reference out and they tried to get people up there in all seasons, and he thought the snow sports would take off. But instead of describing the bleakness of winter and, cold, wet feet, which was what you have to put up with there in the winter months, they would wax lyrical in this brochure about the exhilaration of sliding over a fresh fall of snow or the musical sound the wooden skis made as they broke through a thin crust. But, most Australians had never met snow, let alone skis, skates or snowshoes. So that idea never took off. But the photographers would come in winter because of the landscape was so beautiful. And even climbing the summit, he said in that brochure, or they said in that brochure, that access is easy. There is no difficulty there except for those who look for it. And that was what I had ringing in my mind when I climbed it, and I was terrified. So they left a lot out, and that was part of the ruse to get people to leave behind their doubts and fears and to just venture forth and come what may.
Like all good advertisements, they weren't entirely honest. Mm. What sort of host was Gustav to the guests that did make the journey to Waldheim?
Oh, an amazing host, because he was able to plate up in its heyday, when it was after the war, when it really had taken off, meals for 25. He grew all the vegetables. He'd have stewed rhubarb, stewed apples. He used to say the lettuces were growing like cabbages. So he'd have salad vegetables, and he'd cook what they called roast pork, but was really a bush pork, they'd call it.
What's
roast bush pork?
What's
what was
bush
wombat
pork?
Meat? And it tasted apparently like young beef. So, yes, so he had to do everything there. He had to get the wood. They had to keep guests warm. He had to find the food. He had to grow the food. And then he would take them on these extraordinary walks. And as he said, one direction is as good as another. We could go. And he also used to say it was a place where there is no time and nothing matters. And because he had this rich understanding of the history of the geology, the dolerite rock, which is rare in the world but quite common in Tasmania, and the botanical variety of plants there, and the glacial moraines, he was just a walking, talking encyclopedia, and people loved that about him. And he was able to communicate with, inquiring minds and amateurs as well. He could stretch everybody by taking them somewhere where they hadn't expected to go.
Just coming back to those poor wombats or bush pork, he'd also do experiments on wombats. What was one of the things that he was trying to work out about what wombats
could swim? So I suspect he did this with Professor Theodore Thompson Flynn, who was the actor Errol Flynn's father, who was a zoologist and was studying the reproductive system of marsupials. And so there were many experiments carried out on the wombats. But they needed the wombat's brain for research, and so they had to kill it, and they held it underwater, and it took a very long time to drown, apparently. But at the same time,
they could swim when they threw the other wombats in.
They could swim. Yep, nothing. The dusky coloured pelt. The wombat just shook himself off and walked off without so much as a, you know, never mind. No damage was done to them. And but of course, they did raid the bush, and he did hunt and snare animals to feed himself and to feed the guests. But at the same time, he also argued the case for being concerned with their preservation, you know, against game hunters. Too many game hunters, he felt, would wipe them out.
In these years when Waldheim was first taking off, Kate, what was happening with Kate's health? What was keeping her from spending more time up at the mountain with Gustav?
Yes, well, she had been such a robust, healthy young woman. And then in 1915, she started to have these chest pains, and the doctor thought it was indigestion, you know, very primitive medical services, of course, in those days. Then they found a lump in her chest, and so I suspect it was probably cancer of the breast that might have metastasized into the lungs. But she just began to wane and become very sickly. And
what sort of treatment was offered?
Well, she had the x-rays were done in the Launceston Hospital. She had poultices, you know, morphine to treat the pain, but very little in the way of therapeutic treatment for her, because they just didn't know what it was. And so she just really faded away.
He start spending more time down the mountain? And then if she was in town?
It was just when it was taking off. It was just this tragic timing, sense of timing. So she never lived to see Waldheim's influence grow or the park proclaimed. She died in April 1916, and that summer had been the first summer when they had a big party of scientists who were coming up for the first time. They would be terrific salesmen for the enterprise, and so she didn't hold him back. The doctor said that Kate was well enough to go, and he went up there to look after this party, and she grieved for that, and that she couldn't be there, but she also understood. So great maturity on her part, I think, to let him go. And when he was up there, of course, someone who had received a telephone call in a mining town down the mountain, and they rushed up to Cradle and left a note on the table saying that they couldn't hear whether Kate was either no worse or worse, but he was wanted down the mountain. So he just had to leave immediately and come down. And he spent that time with her back and forth, going in and out of the hospital. People Baronia from the valley to counter the antiseptic whiff in the ward,
and one of her beloved dogs
Fuxi to hold. And she made a codicil to her will before she died, 3 days before she died, so they spoke the end. They knew that this was coming. It was very, very sad, I think.
How old was she?
She was 52, so he was 40, and she was 52 when she died. And, you know, to be left on his own too, even though he was, of course, incredibly resilient and very manlike. The day she died, he wrote in his diary, "Today I have lost my best friend," and then glorious day, because he always took the temperature of the weather, even though he'd had this seismic disruption in his heart. It was such a strange, a paradoxical sort of pairing of sentiments, you know, because she was his best friend, and he never found another to share that place in the wild, because she was so special. I just don't think other women would have been comfortable up there, being so far away from the companionship of other women and, you know, transport, shops, all of those things that women tend to, in those days particularly, love. And she was just such a different creature.
Kate died in 1916, and the Great War was in full swing at that point. What did that mean for the Austrian-born Gustav?
Well, reading about that time was interesting for me in our history, because it's not something I had really been aware of, but there was a lot of aggression towards German and Austrians in the cities, so that there were marauding mobs that would go around with bottles, lick it up, and, you know, throw rocks and break windows at the German club, the Austria club, because these clubs were all established in cities. And Gustav was also dealt the similar sorts of hostility. He was expelled from the Ulverston Club, which was a social club that he belonged to. His dog was poisoned.
His dog was poisoned.
Dog was poisoned with strychnine. He didn't have proof of this, but it was, you know, typical of the sort of times. And he was under surveillance from military intelligence. They'd come up there to see what he was doing, and there were also suspicions of the bathtub and the stove.
Wait a minute. I'm not a military intelligence officer. What does a bathtub, what danger is posed by a bathtub?
I know, but people, you know, the scuttlebutt and was reports were made and they had to be investigated.
But he just had, what was it, the copper brass? Well,
the Premier had said, beware, people, beware. Look for an
look
antenna.
For Austrians bathing.
Yeah, that's right.
Report them immediately.
Anything that could be used. You think it might be a clothesline? No, they're actually sending secret messages home to Europe. So he was under suspicion, but I suspect his first biographer, George Bergman, describes him as very naive because all his letters were opened by the censors. So they'd had the grubby fingerprints of the interested locals, but then, of course, the official censors would, and friends would say to him, we're not sealing our letters because we're saving the censor the trouble. He also helped friends get mail into Austria through his contacts in Switzerland and America. So he did things that he could have been hauled into an internment camp for if they'd ever discovered it. He was quite bold in breaking the law. And in those days, you didn't have to do anything. You just had to be suspected of doing something to be interned. So he had a very good friend, Fritz Noetlinger, who was a German geologist who was a very esteemed member of the Royal Historical Society in Tasmania. He'd been set upon at his house in New Norfolk by these gangs. And the day he went to court, he didn't come back for the afternoon session because he'd just been interned. He'd been whipped away to Holsworthy internment camp in Sydney, just on the suspicion that he might help the enemy.
The fact that Gustav was up there at Cradle Mountain, did that protect him from some of that anti-German
Absolutely.
Sentiment?
Absolutely. And, I mean, he was lucky, in a sense, to be up there because, you know, while the debate raged in Melbourne as to whether or not we should listen to German composers, he could pay his Beethoven on the gramophone as loud as he liked, and none of the creatures around Waldheim complained. And it was that being in that solitude where you're in your own universe, you're master of your own realm. So he was really saved, and he had these heartbreaking letters from friends of his in Melbourne who he'd known saying that they were ostracised, that no one invited them out anymore. They never went anywhere. They couldn't because that was the climate and of the time.
Did visitors still come to Waldheim during the war? I mean, even the name Waldheim must have seemed a little bit suspicious.
Exactly. And no, they didn't. So the numbers really dropped off. So they were down to sort of 60 in the early, low 20s during the period of the war. And they only started picking up really again in 1920, 21. So it also impeded his ability to, because he was always trying to get money to fix up parts of the bog across Middlesex Plains. But of course, they wouldn't dare give any money to an outsider.
He wanted a road built.
He wanted a road built. And it's you know, some people have difficulty with that concept. How could someone who's so, in one way, such a conservationist and a preservationist on a road, but because it was so difficult to get there, you know, guests had to bump along in a wagonette that was owned by Bob Quayle, who was a local farmer from Wilmot. And he was like a character out of a Dickens novel with a big white moustache and a droll sense of humour. And he would try and keep the guest's spirit from flagging in this wagonette. He knew every rut and rock along the way, but it was a hard going. And once when he had this party of guests, one of them said to him, is it better further on? And he said, this is a carpet so far, he roared. So he was just one of those, you know, the whole story is veined with these big, larger-than-life characters who were so gutsy and pioneering, you know, in carving out uncharted territory.
You've described how visitors loved Gustav's extraordinary encyclopedic knowledge of the botany. What about scientists overseas? Was he in touch with institutions or individuals outside of Australia?
Yes, well, his hero was Baron von Mueller, Ferdinand von Mueller, who was the inaugural director of the Botanical Gardens in Melbourne, and von Mueller was would send dispersed seeds everywhere throughout Europe, and Gustav was very much in that mould. So he balled up lots of tree ferns and sent them to the Schönbrunn Palace in Austria. He set acacia seedlings, eucalyptus seedlings. And he was, well regarded in the common rooms of Europe. His sister Rosa would always keep him informed as to when his name had been raised, and she would always report on how the plants were growing
so
in these palaces.
So did those seedlings that he sent off to European palaces from Cradle Mountain take
they
flower?
They did, except the Second World War. The last two tree ferns that were growing were destroyed in that time, but they did take off. And he just wrote prodigiously for popular press in Australia and academic publications. But he really wanted to lift the scales from our eyes and try to convince us that our landscape was beautiful, and why were we hardwired for roses and oaks? You know, why were we importing weeds when we had this magnificent vegetation that we could grow in our own gardens? So they really worked hard at that.
How was he noticing the wilderness changing around him, even in those years that he'd been there at Cradle Mountain, in terms of human impact?
Well, he was very concerned at the time when they made the second big push for the park in the 1921-22, the disappearance of kangaroos and wallabies. And
he was noticing that.
He
himself.
Was noticing that change. Hard to know how much of it was part of his political push, and how much of it he was really seeing. He was so interested in climate. He was really an early ecologist, I think, and he'd take 30 readings from this weather station that he built out the front of Waltham with instruments that he'd MacGyvered or cadged from fellow scientists. And he was interested in looking at whether or not the climate had once been wetter there by studying the growth rings in tree trunks.
Which is something scientists do now.
Well, they've just done this. The last year they concluded they've constructed a 1700-year chronology from a Kingbilly pine that came from Cradle Valley. So he was really onto something. And he had a very wet year in 1923. I think he had more rain than they have in Tierra del Fuego. And he thought this was a distinction. And the vegetation had appeared so vibrant that season. He thought, I wonder if it was once wetter here. And that was what the plants were used to. So that was why he started looking at it. But such a forward thinker, so ahead of his time in every single sphere.
How did he try to convince politicians that this part of Australia should be protected?
Well, it takes a village to raise a child. It takes more than a village to get a national park declared. And luckily they had the head of the Tourist Bureau at that time was an outdoors wordsmith who fell in love with Waltham. This is how it all happened. People came there and they felt quite undone there, you know, the beauty of it and the place and the landscape. And this young crew of photographers arrived from Launceston who were 10 years younger than him, and they discovered it, you know, they were coming to walk there, but they discovered Waltham by accident. And they sat around that fireplace until the wee hours of the morning talking about mountain adventures and national parks, and they brought their cameras up there and they took the most magnificent photographs. And there was a woman there too, Florence Perrin, and she's my favourite photographer because the men all went for the breastfeeding panoramas of this, you know, dramatic, sublime landscape, and she took the interior view of the forests and the trees and concentrated on them in close-up, so she brought a different sensibility.
Sounds like Kate.
Yes, well, she was like Kate. In fact, Florence loved seaweeds, and that was her sort of botanical area of botanical expertise. So they didn't meet, though, because they came up in 1920-21 and Kate had already died by that time. But Gustav always had a photograph of Kate on his desk in the living room, so she was a presence there, and I think he would have heard her in the landscape and seen her in the landscape even if she wasn't physically present.
But this newer generation or younger group of people who were walking and taking photographs, that helped push
They formed a northern branch of the Royal Historical Society in Launceston, so that gave them a push. They took all their photographs and showed lantern slides all around the feeder towns, and because that was the way people could see the landscape, because otherwise they might not go. But no matter how finely, you know, words are wrought, the power and punch of a black and white image, you know, it just flicks that switch.
I think about that famous photograph in the Franklin River that was essential.
That's
in
right.
That campaign.
Peter Bromsky, yes, absolutely. Devil's Bend. I mean, it's ingrained in people's minds in the same way that Ansel Adams and Carlton Watkins's photographs of Yosemite really got the Congress and the public aware of these glacial landscapes.
Did it work? Was Cradle Mountain declared
park? It did, and Gustav went down to Hobart and he just lobbied, knocked on doors with that members of the Launceston crew who were fully behind him, and Temple Emmett, who was the head of the Tourist Bureau at the time, and they were able to get it declared in 1922 as a reserve, and that covered the whole north end of the park, which is Cradle, and the south end of the park, which is Lake St Clair, so it became the Lake St Clair Cradle Mountain National Park. It was, you know, one of the very early parks to be declared in Australia, and it's interesting that no one's really, you know, we've been, I think, very neglectful of the history of these places, you know, because they all draw on these extraordinary characters who would, you know, A, be aware of them, B, be walking in them, and C, telling everybody else to come up and share them.
Well, as well as walking, Gustav decided to get a motorcycle, an Indian Scout motorcycle.
Secondhand.
How did he learn to ride it?
Well, he one of the, H.J. King, who was a photographer, part of the Launceston crew, who took beautiful photographs. His father owned a motorbike shop in Launceston. So it was a second-hand one, and when H.J. King came up to teach him how to ride it, he was told he had to ride it out of the valley on his own, and he did. And that gave him some mobility for the first time, because he still didn't have the road. The road wasn't built until after he died, so it was such a blow to him. But at least he could get out, and he would, because he was still on his own, he still hadn't found another, and he would come either to the mainland or to the east coast to visit friends
on his Indian Scout motorbike.
Yeah, but it was, you know, he had terrible trouble starting it, of course.
How did things end for Gustav?
Well, he was heading out for one of these trips. He'd written letters to people that he'd left on the kitchen table. He'd got the Mabel, he called the motorbike, out from the shed, which looked like a smaller version of the chalet. You know, everything was certainly in form there. And he rode it down to the flats, where he was using a block to try and get it to start and then roll it down the hill. And it was in the process of starting that he had a massive coronary and fell down on the ground probably softened that fall by a sort of feathery sphagnum bed, and he could have laid there for 6 weeks, because, you know, there were times when no one arrived there for 6 weeks, especially in winter. But luckily for him, some cattlemen who'd had their herd grazing there came up and found him there, and they brought him down the mountain to Sheffield.
Where was he buried? Where is he buried?
Well, he's buried up in the mountain, and he. The sad thing is, Kate's buried in her family plot near Devonport, and Gustav was on his way to join her when the Launceston crew intervened and rang up the Attorney General and said, "We have to reverse the order of the bearer and take him back up the valley." But, you know, I think it would be lovely if they could exhume Kate and bring her body up there to lie with his in the valley, because they both, you know, are the genius loci, I think, or the spirits or custodians of this place.
Kate, what a wonderful story. Thank you so much for sharing it with me on Conversations.
Well, it's been delightful talking with you, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Kate Legge's book is called Kindred, A Cradle Mountain Love Story. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.